see some faces back with us we haven't seen in a while. Mr. Evans, Dr. Evans was talking about pumpkin. I heard a joke this week. What's the circumference of a pumpkin? Pi. All right. So there. It had to happen at least once, right? Well, like I said, it's good to be here. I feel a little not up to snuff here. You have Dr. Evans and Dr. Booth. For those of you who don't know, he was raised a doctor this year with all the work he's done with Ed Hauser. If you see his updates on Facebook, he plays one on Facebook. So it's comforting to know we have a couple of doctors in the house here this afternoon in case anything goes awry. To start, I'd like to say that men are different from women in a lot of ways, as we all know. But certainly when it comes to questions, men like questions that have simple yes or no response. Right? We like that. It ends there. There's no ambiguity. There's no further questioning. We like that. And it starts as a boy. Right? When you're a boy, you like yes and no, but it doesn't really work that way. A lot of times your mom will say, "Do you expect me to believe you didn't know what time it was?" So right off the bat, your mind's racing. Which way do you answer these questions? What did I tell you to do when we go out? How are you supposed to behave? Those are tough questions. Your dad usually asks more direct yes, no answer. Did you cut the grass? Yeah. Did you close the door? Yeah. Did you do your homework? Yes. Right? We like that as men. Just telling you women, that's how we like to operate. It doesn't get easier, though, right? As you grow older and you get married and your wife, sometimes they'll ask these questions that we really enjoy, right? My wife will call from work sometimes and she says, "I'm thinking about making spaghetti for dinner. Does that sound good?" Yes, right? I have food. I like spaghetti. There's nothing else that can go wrong with that question. Yes, it's good, right? She says, "You know, you're probably tired tonight. Do you want to watch a movie?" Yes, no, yes. But we don't get a lot of those, right? We just don't get a lot of those as men. Typically, we get things like, "Are you telling me you don't know why I'm upset?" Now, that's a very tricky question to answer. And it's part of my theory on why a lot of men are computer programmers, because you got to think really quick. Your mind has to go from 0 to 120 miles an hour on a question like that. You're thinking about spaghetti, and she's saying, "Do you know why I'm upset?" If you say no, like that's where the computer programming comes in, right? If you say no, that leads down a path. If you say yes and you guess wrong, that's another path. And all this stuff is stored on hardware, and it'll come up later. And so that's why so many men are computer programmers, because they grow up with this line of questioning and logic. And then you get the question from your wife where she says, "Do you remember why today is special?" Again, another difficult yes, no question. It goes in many different difficult paths. And you're thinking, yeah, it's Thursday, which is great. Tomorrow's Friday. That's good for me. That's good enough for me, right? But there's probably more to that question that I'm not picking up on, right? So it's difficult for men. Do you remember when we asked that question by our wife? That first opening start is pretty difficult. I didn't mean to do it to a couple I met last week. They were married for not too long, and I was talking to them, and I asked them, I said, "How long have you been married?" Right? That's always the problem question to ask a guy in front of his wife as he's trying to calculate, right? So do you remember? We're always asked a lot of things in life when it comes to remembering things, right? Those of you who are still in school, those of you sitting up in the back, right? You have to remember a lot when it comes to tests. And I remember going in and taking a test and trying to just spill as much as you could, as fast as you could before you forgot it. You have to remember. When you're learning math, I remember teaching the kids, 19 plus 11, 9 plus 1 is 0, carry the 1, remember to carry the 1. Right, we spend a lot of our life trying to remember things. Going to the feast is always an interesting experience. When you rent a car, they always give you only one key. And I commented to the guy about that. Like, can't you guys give out two keys? Because you have to go about 10 days remembering where that key is. Because if you lose that key, the whole trip changes. Right? And heaven forbid if the kids come and say, "Dad, can I borrow the key to put something in the car?" Borrow the key? Not the key, right? Because are you going to remember not to have your hands full and then slam it shut and the key's got locked? Ooh, you got to remember. You're remembering all these things. And how about if you're a mother, right? How many times have you told your kids, "Remember to wear your coat. Remember to take the vitamins. Remember, don't touch this. Remember, remember, remember." We do so much in life, we have to remember your password. Right? Heaven, if you forget your password, right, life comes to an end. You have to remember and remember. We go through life thinking about all these different things. Where did I park the car here at church? Was it on this side or was it on that side? Well, my kids will tell me eventually, but you got to remember these things. So you spend a lot of time. And that's all important. And we need to do that. That's part of life. But this afternoon, I want to talk about something from the Bible. There's four things I want to concentrate on that spiritually. Spiritually, if we take this Bible, there's so many things in here, you'd be surprised how many times it tells us as Christians to remember, remember, remember. It's almost as like when we're talking about our lives. There's a lot to remember. I want to boil it down this afternoon to four main areas, four main things that are really critical, really important. Like there's things in life, in our day-to-day lives, that we just have to remember. And it's the same way with what God wants us to do when it comes to being Christians, when it comes to remembering, remembering the important things. We heard already about the feast. Remember the feast, right? How much remembering do we do? We do a lot of that. We go back and remember. But God has also told us to remember certain things, certain very, very important things. So today, and I was trying to think what was the origin of this sermon. Sometimes you get certain thoughts and things come to mind. But I'm sure the feast was part of it, remembering the feast. But I'm also thinking, too, as the kids get older, you want them to remember. You're telling them, remember this. You know, as a parent, as those days draw to a close before they leave, it's all remember, remember, remember. And I can picture God with us, right, as his children. All remember. We heard that in the sermonette, right? There's two ways things can go, right? Two choices, two paths. Remember, go this way, go that way. So I want to talk about four areas that are very, very important to us as Christians. So I'm going to ask them in the form of a question. They're not quite as painful as when a lady asks you a question, because those are usually not easy yes-no questions. But I'll put them in the form of a question so we can think about them this afternoon. First one is, do you remember who God is? Sounds pretty easy. Sounds pretty straightforward. Of course we do. You know, we live pretty close to the Colts complex on the west side of Indianapolis. And I always like it, usually on Friday afternoons or Friday mornings before a home game, they're blowing up this huge Colt, this little inflatable football player. And it'll say on there, beat the Titans or something like that. And it's just huge. It's just real big and it's fun to see. And when I see that, I always think, wow, you know what? Who could beat the Colts? Look how big they are. You know, they're awesome. Look how big that is, right? And when I go to the feast, doesn't something happen to you as well as you go day one, day two, day three? It's like that God is getting bigger. At least it happens for me that way. As we go to the feast, as we worship, as we sing, as we hear messages, God gets bigger. Bigger in our mind. He becomes large to us. We become very worshipful of God. We start to see the greatness. We stand in awe of who he is. We hear more about his majesty. We hear more about his plan. And God becomes bigger for those 8 days. It's a wonderful process. It's wonderful to have that vision of God in our mind, to create that and to think about that and to meditate. And as we all sit here humanly, there's just absolutely no way in this lifetime we can even begin to touch or approach or understand how awesome God is. How just incredible. It's just something that escapes us. But we get glimpses, and we get times when we feel that, and we see that, and we're taken back by the power of it. I'm not comparing the Colts player to God. It was just an open analogy there. But at the feast, you understand that God takes on that feeling in our mind, and it's a very good thing. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy 7. I did appreciate the sermonette because a lot of this does tie in, and how we approach our very lives, how we look at things is driven in large part of our view of God and how we see God. Look at Deuteronomy. I love the book of Deuteronomy. I love chapters 7 and 8 in particular. And when you read chapter 7, this again is Moses. It's almost like a grandfather talking to grandchildren, because now he's talking about that young generation going into the land because their parents were not going to go in. He's telling them and giving them instructions. It's really an unbelievable download of a man who had spent the better part 80 years of his life with God in a very powerful way and doing things and having that direct connection, now just telling them words of wisdom, telling them how to live, telling them about the God he knows. Right? Isn't that what we should be doing? Shouldn't God becoming bigger for all of us, and we share that concept of God and who he is? Look what he says in Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, in verse 17. And we can change the wording here to put it more. Think of yourself. We heard some of this in the sermonette, but think of yourself. If you would say in your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispose of them? This problem is bigger than me. How do I handle it? This situation is more than I can bear. What do I do with it? This problem is more than I know how to handle. What does Moses say in verse 18? As he's talking to these children and knowing they're going to see things, what does he say to them? You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember well. Remember well what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh in Egypt. Remember what happened in your life 2 years ago when you had that situation, that problem, and it looked like it wasn't going to self-correct. And God stepped in ways we couldn't even think of. And he worked it out. Remember what God did. Remember what he did to Pharaoh in Egypt when you were stuck there with nowhere to go, and it was water and it was mountains and all looked lost. How's that going to work out? What's God going to do? Don't forget that, he says in verse 19. The great trials which your eyes saw, the signs, the wonders, the mighty hand, and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So shall the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. So shall God do to all the things that you're wrestling with, that I'm wrestling with, that we all secretly and openly are dealing with. That's the God who's there. That's the God who can do those things. Isn't it so easy? Because we look back in the Bible, how could they have forgotten that? They saw so many unbelievable things. We've seen some amazing things too. God has dealt powerfully in our lives, but it's easy sometimes to forget. And the size of God seems to diminish and come down, and sometimes we forget. We forget who we serve. You know, I'm excited. This fall, we're going to initiate, the church is initiating an official concept in the youth program, the youth lessons this year. Again, it's in the book of Deuteronomy, so when I say it's a new program, it's not new. This goes back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, where I think it's exciting. We're going to start classes here later this month with all the young people, and it's going to be built on Deuteronomy 6, which is very much family first, family education in the home. Instruction is there, as it talked about in Deuteronomy 6. But I would encourage everyone to go online and look at members at the members site, and it has basically the lesson outlines that are going to be, the topics for the school year. And basically what it's all centered around is God. God, his plan, who he is, what he's doing, his purpose. Spend years on that, right? What a great topic. What a great starting point. That's going to go from now until May. What a great thing to enlighten, to get young people to understand at some level, to get us to understand at some level who God is, how he's always existed, what he's doing, his power, his purpose, and spend lessons on that and teach our young people that. I'm real excited and encouraged when I saw that. That's going to be a great opportunity for our young people to hear that and to understand who God truly is. Look at Psalm 77, verse 11. Psalm 77. We know David so often went through so many difficult things and different things, but he's a good barometer always to go back to and look at what he says. When you get to those spots, when you get to those times, as Israel was before they were going to enter the promised land, as you are, wherever you are in your life right now, wherever I am right now, whatever situation, we are going through, and it all seems, when you're in that moment, it always seems, as we heard again in the sermonette, it always seems most overwhelming, most unique, never faced before by anyone else, right? Because why? Because I'm going through it. And no one's quite gone through it the same way. No one's ever experienced this. And it all seems very, very difficult, very, very challenging. I certainly appreciated Mr. Kubik's sermon during the feast. Made us all, I hope, stop and think and understand, certainly the times we live in, the things that we see. And again, it's a good sober reminder. I am very encouraged again in the church and striking a balance of watching. But I love his comments about not getting overly, you know, trying to figure out dates and set them. And he says, if you think you got it right, God will change it so you're not right. And I love that part because we've been, it's just good to have that balance, but to have that right balance of watching and looking. And what he described was pretty scary times, right? If we're in it alone, it seems unique. But if you look over the years, so many people have gone through difficult things. And we get there because we think and we know, we understand God. And God hopefully becomes bigger and bigger in our minds. And who he is and what he's capable of doing, because otherwise it is a little scary. Look at Psalm 77 and verse 11 and what David says. I will remember the works of the Lord. Sometimes it's good just to do that. Sit and reflect, go back through what God has done in his Bible, in his word, in your life. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and talk of your deed. What a great thing to do when we elevate sometimes. We have to evaluate, you know, our words and what we do, but to talk about God and his greatness and what he's done and to be filled with that. That's why I think the feast is such a wonderful microcosm, because we have time. Our thoughts are geared that way. But this is what David says when he went back and he talked about those deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as you are, God? It's wonderful when we start remembering who God is, who God truly is. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now, Deuteronomy 6, it's interesting. This is what I said, the model that the church is using. Is if you read the first part of Deuteronomy 6, you will see the instruction very much to train up your children wherever you are, where you walk, when you lie down, wherever you get a chance. Now, sometimes for children, that might be a bit of a different situation. They might not always want to hear instruction when you walk and you lie down and you get up at the breakfast table, right? But that's an instruction to parents here to certainly do that, and that's what's talked about here. And I think it's interesting, the very same chapter of Deuteronomy 6 where it talks about doing that, look what it says in verse 20, because you do all this work, right, as parents, and you instruct when they're young, and you do all these different things. Look what it says, excuse me, in verse 20. Verse 20, it says, when your son asks you in time, when he asks you in time, becomes saying, what's the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, the judgments? What's the meaning of the Sabbath, the holy days, the things we do, the things we believe? Dad, mom, why do we do that? What's it all about? What do you say to your son? What do you say to your daughter? What do you say to a young person who comes up and asks you that? Because we've taught them. See, in the first part of Deuteronomy 6, that's where it says, teach them all the time, wherever you are, when you sit in the house, when you walk, when you lie down, when you rise up, do all those things. But one day they'll come back and ask you, why do we do these things? Because we want them. We want them to have a relationship. We want this to be their relationship at some point with God. So what's the answer here in verse 21? He says, then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out with a mighty hand. We serve a great God. There's a great God who brought us out of a spot that was hopeless, right? And verse 22, and the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all. We saw the greatness of this God we're telling you about. There's a great God that's greater than anything in our life. And he brought us out from there, and that he might bring us in and give us the land which he swore to our fathers. He took us from a very bad spot, and he's promised us very good things in a new land. God wants to give us everything. God wants to put us in a spot that is very good for us. In verse 24, and the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God. Why? Because God just wants to make your life miserable. He wants you to just have all these laws and rules and regulations and no fun in life, so it's just miserable. And you come with older people with Bibles and sit in church, and it's not that fun. And when are we going to go home? Is that what God wants? He says, no, it's for your good. For your good, always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for all of us. So you think about, and again, I said we can't grasp the concept of God and who he is. The one who has all power and all glory wants to have a relationship with us. Wants to have a relationship with our children. It's a thought that's staggering. It's a thought that's sometimes beyond us when we think about it. It was interesting this summer, earlier this year, our children had a chance to meet Governor Pence, which is very interesting. We were at an event. We went up, took the courage, went up and shook hands, and it was really neat because here's the man who has the most powerful political office in the state. Very powerful. Met him for all of 10, 15 seconds, but again, no relationship, no connection, but he was a powerful man. It was fun to see that and to have that interaction. When I worked at Nestle Food Company out in California, I can still remember the gentleman who was our CEO, who was over all of Nestle USA. In that time, Nestle was about a $50 billion company, and they're the biggest food company in the world. Now they're about, I would say, over $100 billion. Big company. 21 stories in California. I was on a different floor than he was. Our worlds didn't connect very often, believe me. But several times I found myself in the elevator with him. Very, very intimidating. I mean, what do you ask? What's your favorite candy bar? Right? I just wanted to get off the elevator. All right? But he said to me on more than one occasion, hey, Don, how are things going in the county? Whoa. CEO. And he would have meetings. We'd have a State of the Union once a year. 3,000 employees, 1,500 in the morning, 1,500 in the afternoon. He'd be up here speaking like this and saying, Les, we did some great things in marketing this year, didn't we? Sam did some great things in operational. Say he called out people by name. And I thought, wow, when I left that meeting and walked across the street and went back to my little cube, I was ready to take the hill. Why? Because he took enough time, had enough care, to know my name, to know another person's name, and to be involved. I could trust him. Again, we weren't buddies. I didn't know him that well. But take it to the level I'm talking about here. God is intimately involved. The most awesome, powerful being in the universe wants to have a relationship with you, with me, and our children. That's the God we're talking about because God is so powerful, so awesome. But what makes it work is that he says, I want to care for you. I love you. I want you. I want to have a relationship with you. That's pretty spectacular. And then when God says in here, he says, keep my laws, keep my commandments. Again, it's not because God wants to be onerous. He wants to make our life difficult. What's the one commandment where God uses the word remember? Back row. Our teens should know that. Remember the Sabbath. Why remember the Sabbath? Just so, again, that's a 24-hour period of time where God doesn't want us to have any kind of enjoyment. No, it's because we can use that time to build that relationship that he desires to have with us. Remember that Sabbath because use that time. We come here to build a relationship with the most incredible being in the universe. That's what makes remembering who God is so important to us. You can just jot down Jeremiah 29, verse 11, one of my favorite scriptures where God says, I know my thoughts I have for you. I want to give you peace. I want to give you hope. That's what God desires to give us, the most powerful being in the universe. And when we know that, when we feel that, when we understand that, a person, a being we can trust because he cares for us, his love is there, then we obey him. Then we trust him. Then we confide in him. Then we cry out to him. But it gets difficult, doesn't it, at times, because you do those things sometimes and you don't get the answer. Times are difficult. We heard about the prayer request. We heard about the very, very difficult year for the Housers. I remember when I was at this time last year transitioning between jobs. It was difficult. There were times when God seemed small to me. It seemed like God didn't care as much at that time. When you're going through a tough, tight spot, doesn't it feel that way sometimes? Where is this God I'm speaking of here? Where is this awesome and wonderful and powerful God? So many of you have health issues, financial issues. He can be a God who doesn't seem to care, who doesn't seem to be there. I remember those nights, sometimes not sleeping very well, my wife saying, you know, either he is or he isn't. Again, women say things that just cut right through. There's no, it's true, at 3 a.m., either he is or he isn't, right? Either this God I described is or he isn't. And that's where it gets tough at times when you feel those difficulties, but God is there. He knows what is good for us. Sometimes we don't always see it as clearly. We want that trial to end. We want the phone to ring tomorrow and something to change. But God says he does care. I have good plans for you. We have to be able to reconcile that. I want to give you peace. I want to give you hope. And the point I want to make, coupled with all this, is that you come to a point where we have to say, if he is, then his timing is perfect. His timing is perfect. And we think of this past year, Mr. Booth alluded to it, it's been quite a year. Quite a year, but quite a year of understanding and seeing God's hand in ways we couldn't see fully at the time. I marvel at the things that God has done for his glory. For his glory. For things that we thought sometimes, you know, you get to a spot, you ever get to a spot, maybe it's just pride, where you get to a spot sometimes where you get tired of hearing yourself saying, I don't understand why it worked that way. Why did they do that? That doesn't make sense. This shouldn't have worked that way. Why are they going... You get to a spot, most times you say, you know what? I can't see, understand God's perfect timing. I don't see it. And I look back at certain events that happened last summer, going back a year ago, and different things at the time, and says, wow, this is upside down. Where is God? Now you look at it, it's like a beautiful orchestra. Maybe we heard just the orchestra warming up. But boy, it was beautiful when it got done. And now you look back and you go, wow, you just couldn't have planned it that way. Could not have had it work out that way if we were in charge. If we were in charge, we understand God's care and his love and his time. And this is a theme we see over and over again in our lives. We talk sometimes, we'll keep going through it and repeat it until we start to grow and keep growing and understanding that. I think we're getting there, which is encouraging. I hope I'm getting there. Sometimes you look at things like that and you think, yeah, you know what? I'm done speculating. I'm done wondering. God is awesome. God is perfect. God is love. God's timing is perfect. He will work it out. Last comment I'll make on this point is we were at the feast in Canmore, Alberta, and Bob Dick was up there. He's the pastor for Portland, Oregon. He gave two excellent sermons. They were, some of you I know have already said you've played them online. I would encourage you to do so. He was talking about the Beatitudes. He called it 8 Steps to the Kingdom. He talked about the 8 Beatitudes. And he talked about blessed are the meek. And meek is always a difficult one to try to put a definition around. And again, I don't want to quote him directly, but this is my interpretation, so you might want to catch it live from him. But the gist of what I took away from that, he said when a person is truly meek, right, there's inner strength. There's an inner strength there, not because of anything we have, but because of that relationship, that reliance, that trust, that waiting, that hope we place in God, that God will work it out. I don't need to worry, to settle the score, to question, to wonder. There's a certain meekness. There's a calm because there's a reliance. There's a relationship now that is walking with God. That's one of the end products when we remember who God is, who we are waiting on. We leave God. There's a verse I skipped over. You can jot down Nehemiah 4. When they were defending the wall and they all took their swords and their instruments and they said, remember, who's fighting for us? There's a certain calm that comes over you. There's a certain, that term meek, what a wonderful thing when you have a confidence, a strength, because you know that God. Turn with me to Luke. Luke 22 and verse 19. Partial to the book of Luke. Luke 22, verse 19, something we're very familiar, something we read about. At Passover, in verse 19, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, gave it to them, saying, this is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Do you remember the example of Jesus? We talk about remembering things. Do I remember? Do you remember who God is? Do we remember the example of Jesus? Now, I think there's two parts to this. When Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. It's a powerful, powerful thing that he did there. But certainly the first part of this is remembering what Jesus has done that we couldn't accomplish for ourselves. Remember me by taking this bread, as we do every year annually. Remember what I've done. Remember the sacrifice I've made for you that makes eternal life possible. What a wonderful thing that we should constantly be calling to mind. That salvation is made possible because of the plan of God and the willing sacrifice made by Jesus Christ. Secondly, remembering, though, often does result in some type of action. Right? If I were to go to my wife on our anniversary and say, honey, I remembered today's our anniversary. And then went to work, and that was the day. That'd be not that great, right? So remembering's okay, but it should prompt some type of action. So when Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me, take this bread, which is my life, represents who I am, and put this inside. Be changed by it. Live differently. Do something. Have actions now that make you more like me. All these first two topics are huge, right? We could spend many series of sermons on them. So when I say all the things that Jesus gave us for an example, it's huge, right? There's so many things we can look to. But just jot down a few things because we want to say when we do this and we take Jesus in and we remember him, that we become followers of Jesus, recognized by him. That's really the ultimate goal, right? That we live and we become like Jesus so one day he recognizes us. You can just jot down John 10, verse 14. He says, I am the good shepherd, I know my sheep. My dad and his brothers grew up on a farm up in Canada, and I always marvel when you're around people with 50 or 75 cows and they know them all. They know the differences. To me, I would spend years probably and there'd be big cows coming in the barn. Right? But these, they know the movement. They know when there's something off, but they know they're sheep. Right? God, Jesus will recognize us as he lives in us. He said, I know my sheep. And in verse 27, they hear my voice and they follow. Follow me. The only point I'm going to say under this one is very simply that whole concept of following Jesus. Look at John, I'll turn to this verse, John 12. Because there's so many examples of Jesus we could point to. When we say remember Jesus, people have had wristbands, WWJD. Remember Jesus, remember the example. More than remember, put something in action. Do something, be transformed, that our lives would now represent Jesus Christ, that we'd be known. I'm not going to turn to that one verse we don't like that says, I did all these great things for you, Lord. And he says, boy, I really don't know you. I don't. Oh, that's not what I'm going to turn to this afternoon. We're going to stay on the other side where he says, no, I know you. I know my sheep because you are being transformed. You're having my spirit live in you. Look what it says. I need to give one example of what we can do in terms of that. John 12. John 12 and verse 49. John 12, verse 49. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me. We know this verse very well. The Father who sent me gave me a command what I should say and what I should speak. At so many levels, there's so many things happening there. It's just the total subjugation of his spirit, of his will. He's part of the Godhead. And he says, and I know that his command is everlasting life. Powerful statement as well. When we come to know that the commands that God give us is life everlasting. We start thinking of it that way. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak. It's such an awesome thing when you see children who have such a strong desire to obey, strong desire to want to line up, a strong desire. And Jesus lived 3.5 years. His entire ministry was there to deflect anything from self but to follow God implicitly at every level, at every level. And we talk about that, that our attitude will become more shaped and wanting to become that way that we have this quick desire to line up, to obey. I remember a fond memory I'll have always is when we lived in California. I had the opportunity to coach some of the, at that time, the YU basketball teams. And one of the teams I had Mike Kubik on my team back in California. We're going back a few years. But I also had the opportunity to coach the Spanish team, which was quite interesting because they spoke very little to no English, and I certainly spoke no Spanish. So a lot of hand signals and communication, working through one kid who knew 5 words to tell him to do this kind of thing. But the instant, the look in the eye, the desire to want to obey, to want to comply, it's a beautiful spirit. It's a spirit that's there, and it's just what Jesus is describing. And it was a pleasure. It was a joy. I can still see those young boys and the look in their eyes, making eye contact, and so desirous to do what I wanted them to do. And they shot the wrong bat. They were great. That attitude, that desire. Mike Snyder gave a sermon on becoming childlike. How do we get to that spot? It's peeling back all those things that define us, that rely on us, that look to us with our understanding, with our take on it. With everything's a take, a spin, a blog today. So we get used to that. We live that way. It's my voice. He says, everything I came was already scripted in a sense for me. I followed that script. I didn't need to rewrite anything because it came from God who gives everlasting life. I don't want to change that script. You don't want to change that script. That's the script here where he says those are the word life. That we always remember Jesus. I mean, if you think of one thing, again, we could go around the room and you'd say, what would you think of Jesus? There's so many things we could point to, but I think of an example. I'm going to pick out one, that instant, that deep, devoted, obedient to God the Father. Turn for a final scripture in this section to Ephesians 4. Again, verses we know quite well, verses are good to meditate. I always think in terms of memory, again, remembering. I always think of back to Ambassador College days. We had so many tests on memorization verses and thinking of verses. But at the time, it's a little grueling. But now it's a helpful thing as you think and you recount. I always enjoy talking with people that can just know verses and they go to spots and understand. I always try to get the young people to think in those terms too. Have certain verses you go to and you understand and you lean on. We connect with God, and I think of this one very much so, and this is, again, a major mission statement for the church. Ephesians 4 and verse 13. And we talk about, think about, we said about Jesus and the example of Jesus. Look at this, and it talks about the structure of the church and how the church is structured. And again, God just doesn't say okay, we're just going to do this, and there's no real apparent reason. Right? God decides, oh, I'm just going to block out this 24-hour period of time for no apparent reason, and then as soon as the sun goes down, you guys scatter off and do it. It's all with design, with purpose, with, it's said back in Deuteronomy, for our good. Right? But sometimes we've heard people talk over the years, why is it structured this way and the church that way? And it's, God puts things in a spot because he says, what? What's supposed to happen when all this works the right way? In Ephesians 4, verse 13, this is all put in place in verse 13, so we all come to the unity of the faith. There's a oneness that's supposed to happen. That's talked about earlier in this chapter. And the knowledge of the Son of God. That word knowledge, again, I never struggle over the Hebrew and Greek pronunciation. I just give out numbers. So that's number 1907, if you want to look it up later at home. At the root of that word means to pay attention to give heed to. When you come into the knowledge, what does that mean, right? You're listening to what he's saying. You're clinging on those words. You're actually knowing those are words of life. Can you imagine Jesus with the Sermon on the Mount, all those people there? Those words, if we could hear Jesus, we can hear him in his word, though. The words of life, right? So we all come into the knowledge. We all come to a spot where we pay attention. We're in line to a perfect man, a mature man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we're no longer as children tossed to and fro, carried with every wind of doctrine, every trickery of men. Why don't we have to withstand that? And the craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking truth and love, grow up in all things into him who is the head, Jesus Christ. Almost our existence, our reason for being is to become like, to remember the example of Jesus and to become like him. I don't read the comics very often, but one of my favorite comics is Bizarro. Those little snippets they have, and the one I really enjoyed was one day they had two guys at night. Stars were out. They were laying on a hill face down in the grass, and they said, makes you feel kind of significant, doesn't it? Right? Well, that's not my point. My next point is, do you remember where you came from? Do you remember where you came from? And if we do, we don't feel quite significant. We feel rather insignificant. Again, a verse that if you start feeling significant, just turn to Romans 5, verse 8. Romans 5, verse 8, because it is so critical in our walk. How many things have we said, remember, remember, life, remember, remember where we came from, remember who we were. So vital on our Christian journey. So very, very important. Look what it says in Romans 8, 5 and verse 8. God demonstrates his own love towards us. And that while we were still sinners, Christ died. There was nothing good. But in his own love, he reached out and sent his son to die. See, it gets better in verse 10. For if when we were, not just an enemy, opposed to God, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, much more having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. Well, you just need to take time and go back there, right? And that's great. That's at God's plan again and his wisdom and everything he does. You can't get too far off course because annually we go through this at the Passover, right? We prepare. We start thinking again, and we're reminded of who we are. Who we are and what God did for us. Nothing that was good grabbed us out of the trash and hosed us down. Turn to Ephesians 2, verse 11. Ephesians 2, and again, I like taking some of these verses and saying, let's pop our own situation in here. Ephesians 2 and verse 11. He's writing to a church, a group that they were Gentiles. So he's saying in verse 11, therefore remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Christ. We were, all of us at one point, without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and the promises, having no hope, without God. But now in Jesus Christ, you who are far off have been brought near by the blood of God. Think of our situation. Think about where we were cut off with no hope, with no promise. That's where we came from. Nothing that was good of ourselves. So do we spend the rest of our lives just wallowing, remembering that, not moving forward? No, but it's good to understand that. Never lose sight of that. Never lose that. And then because of that, again, God in his wisdom wants us to use that, and we act. You remember that, and now you act. And a lot of times when I say it's great to remember, that's a starting point, but how does it affect? How does it affect how we live? Look back in Deuteronomy 15. I'll give you one Old Testament example and one new one. It's got to impact us when you have that and you realize that you couldn't save yourself. There was nothing you could do. You had no future. You had no hope. And Deuteronomy 15 is talking about a year of release. There's years of release. There's years of jubilee. I think someone here knows a little bit about that. But in Deuteronomy 15, it talks about when you are going to give someone away, someone who is now, their 7 years are up, a slave. It's time to let them go. What does God say? What should happen at that time? Look what it says in verse 13. And when you send him away from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. Right? Isn't it enough you're giving him his freedom? No, God says, don't let him go empty-handed. You shall supply him liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, from your wine press. Give him some good stuff as he heads out. From what God has blessed you with, you shall give to him. Why? Why do I have to give them all that? I took care of him for 7 years. And I sent him on his way. Now, what he says in verse 15, you shall remember. Remember, you were a slave. You were a sinner. You were an enemy. You had no hope. You had no future. And I gave you everything. I redeemed you. Therefore, I command you. Wow. We understand. When we understand where we've come from and we deal with people, where the hope of floodgates of generosity to be evident. That's what God's saying. You had nothing. I gave you everything. Give when you can give. Give deeply. Help. That's the concept he gave here. Now, that's just an Old Testament one, but look at the one in Matthew. Again, I'm going to steal this from Mr. Dick's sermon. Actually, the whole sermon is his sermon. No, it's not. No, I'm going to steal this point from his sermon because, and I'm a little hesitant, but he gave some numbers here that I'm going to quote. I'm uncomfortable because I haven't audited them yet, but I'm going to use them. All right, I'm just going to go with what he said. Goes against everything I believe, but I'm just going to go with it. So, Matthew 18, verse 21. We know this account as well, but I think it's really good to think, and in terms of the numbers he talked about as well, was pretty interesting. Matthew 18, verse 21, then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to 7 times? Sounds like a reasonable number, right? Jesus said, I do not say to you 7, but 70 times 7. And he gives this parable about a kingdom of heavens like a certain king who wanted to settle his accounts and began to settle them. And one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now, Mr. Dick said in his sermon, 10,000 talents in today's money. $180 million, right? You heard about $794,000, a lot of money. $180 million, right? That's what this servant owed in verse 25, but he was not able to pay. Imagine that. His master commanded that he be sold with his wife and his children and all he had, and that payment be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me. I will pay you all. I don't know if you do it in this lifetime, but then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, forgave him his debt. It's staggering, right? $180 million. Talk about sleepless nights. But that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants. Every good turn deserves another, right? Who owed him 100 denarii. In the sermon, he said that was about $16,000. Now, someone owed me $16,000, I'd make a lot of effort to go get that. That's a lot of money, right? 16. But compared to 180 million? So you see the scale, how, we're not close. We're not close on this one. He owed him 16,000. We know the story here. He laid hands on him, took him by his throat, saying, pay me what you owe me. Start to see some of the problem here, the stark reality, when we say, remember, do I remember where I came from? That I had no hope, I had nothing. Now look how I'm dealing with somebody else. How I'm dealing with someone else. I don't have to read the rest of the story, but you know how it ends there, and he goes back in prison. Right? And I really enjoyed Mr. Bornhorst's sermon last week, especially as he talked about his last point about not taking offense. Remember what he said? How we avoid that? How we don't take that in inside our house? Remember where you came from. Remember who we are. What right do I have? Wow. That's a powerful concept. I'm trying to lay out four, I would call them big pillar blocks of remembrance. Remembering where we came from should impact us powerfully in how we act with others. I'm going to steal from the sermon. I'll take one more point from Mr. Dick. He talked about in the Beatitudes. He said, blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Poor in spirit. And he gave the example of a young, you know, when you see those UNICEF commercials and a young girl there with her eyes looking like so helpless. So helpless. Right? And he said, that's really the look of someone who's poor in spirit. It means you feel helpless. There's no fight. There's no, you know, you're lost without help. That's humility. That's understanding where you've come from and where you are. And the gratitude. There's just so many tentacles that spin off this. Gratitude, right? I just thought as we're speaking now, gratitude would spin off that too. Anything someone would show you, you'd have a spirit of gratitude. Not entitlement. There's many things to be said about that, but that's a different time. But do I remember? Do you remember where we came from? The last point of the sermon this afternoon is, Do you remember where you're going? You know, when we think about Satan, Satan has so many devices. He is so good. We are no match for Satan. One of the big things, we say, yeah, we know where we're going. Do we? Do we always know where we're going? Because Satan uses something called despair. We heard about it in the weekend. We hear about it in the sermonette. We hear about it in our lives. He gets us to a point where there's great, can be great despair. He uses all these D words, right? Deception, discouragement. He tried it with Jesus Christ when he tempted him. And it's, but Jesus resisted. For us, it's a little more difficult. It's easy to get in those spots where the path, the vision, where we're going becomes cloudy. We begin to despair. We begin to lose hope. We begin to forget sometimes where we're going. Turn to Romans. We begin to wonder, like I said, where's God? Does he care? Why is this happening? How long will it last? See, these are all sort of connected together, right? So when you get to that spot, when I get to that spot, what do we do? Remember the example of Jesus. It's always a good spot to go. It's not, I can't go and say, it's not happening to him. I'm doing things this way and it's still happening. That's not the equation. The equation is look to the example because what happened with Jesus? Look at Romans 8 and verse 16. Romans 8 and verse 16. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, which is a very, very encouraging. God, like I said in the opening point, if we know who God is, God has established a relationship and calls us his children. Bigger, broader, deeper, than we can understand right now and what that means. But God has said other verses we could turn to, and God says that it's done. Right? For his children. Very, very encouraging. Right? It's almost like a legal contract. But now, Article 6, subsection B. Right? You say your children, look what happens in verse 17. And if children, then heirs, which is great. Promises that God gives us, heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ. What a wonderful future. So I'm saying, we think and you meditate. This is what God holds out to us. This is what he says he gives us. If, however, if indeed we suffer with him, we will also be glorified with him. Jesus Christ came here and suffered every indignity known to man. He suffered and he was glorified. We looked at the example of Jesus. We heard again that I enjoyed the sermonette and the tie-in. There's a lot of suffering and difficulty that we go through. The path gets dark, it gets dim, it gets difficult, but if we suffer, we will be glorified. Sometimes we don't get to that second part of the equation, right? We think, "Why? Well, I'm just suffering. It's hard." It is hard. But he says here, we will be glorified. To have that vision burn brightly. Sometimes it's hard. It is difficult, especially as we heard last week. And that's why, again, I appreciated the sermon, talking about this sort of dead zone period of the year. We heard now, we made it through Halloween, right? You get to these spots, and sometimes we're just trying to fight off all this stuff around. Now we got to get ready for the next onslaught, right? And you forget the vision. It's bigger. What God has given us is bigger. God has called us as children. Especially if you're a guy, it's hard to keep that vision, because if your wife calls and says, we're having spaghetti tonight, in the next 3 hours I'm thinking about that. Right? And that's all you know, so we're very short in our thinking. But if we're going to get somewhere, again, he laid it out. It's a path. Can't be fuzzy. God has held something out. That's why I'm saying it's that piece is this beacon of light. We can all see it pretty clear. And then quickly it fades black. Right? But he says here, no, hold on to these promises. Remember where we're going, individually and collectively. Philippians 3, verse 13. Again, I'm not bringing you a ton of new verses, but these are verses sometimes that it's good for us to go to, good for us to think about, good for us to kick around in our brain sometimes and really, really think through. But what is, you think about Paul and all the things he suffered. What does he say? Philippians 3 and verse 13, brethren, I don't count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do. One thing I do continually, forgetting those things which are behind. So I say, remember certain things. We're supposed to forget the things that good, bad, indifferent, hurts, difficulties, trials, good times, things we wish we hadn't changed, some things. Forget all that. Just forget those things that are behind, and you reach. Just this morning, my wife said, could you use, she says, while you're up there, she meant because I was taller, grab something. When you're reaching for something, right? You're really getting after it. You're reaching forward to those things which are ahead. Constantly, constantly have to be moving ahead, moving forward. And he says, I press. Press is a very aggressive term, too. It's not I leisurely or strolling forward, right? I'm pushing my body into the wind, into the difficulty. That's why I love watching the Olympics, when someone presses forward in the 100-meter dash. Well, it's getting out, in front, because they're pressing to get there. There's an urgency. There's a desire. There's a vision. To press towards the goal. We heard about gold this morning, this afternoon in the sermonette. For the prize, for the upward call of God in Jesus. Wow. I think what a great thing to have somewhere on our refrigerator. You get down, right? So I'm going to be in there a couple times a day, right? You can see that, right, when you're sitting there licking your wounds and wondering why it's all going the way it is. It's reality, right? But he's saying, I've pressed towards that. I have that vision. I have that goal. We know where we're going. One last verse. Mark 10. Two, actually. Sorry about that. Teens are upset with me now. Mark 10, verse 29. Sometimes it's like I said, the Bible is written for our example. There's so many things when you get stopped and you try to put yourself in a situation. Here's Peter talking to Jesus in verse 28, and Peter began to say to him, "See, we've left all and have followed you." What's in it? What's going to happen? We've gone through a lot of things, difficult. We've left it all and we followed you. And Jesus said, "Surely I say to you." Can it seem that way sometimes? People have forgotten the end goal because things have changed. They said, "We left all this and then this happened and oh, man, wasn't all worth it. It all seemed different. It's not what I signed up for. Lost the path, lost the end marker." And Jesus, is, Peter's asking that of Jesus, and Jesus said to him, "Surely I say to you, there's no one who has left homes or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel." This is a very poignant verse for me, and I know for a lot of people who have gone through things and difficulties and had things not quite the way you may have liked it or wanted it in this lifetime. You've had to forsake a lot of things, but you've kept moving forward towards that end goal. And Jesus said, "There's not anyone who hasn't done that who will not receive a hundredfold. And this now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life." I think he says there that we give up a lot physically, but look what we have. We inherit other families and part of God's family and the reach of his family and the persecutions that come with that and suffering with him, that one day we may be glorified, one day we may have eternal life. Keeping that vision, keeping that understanding. And there's many verses we could read about the promises. We know that. And there's laid up a crown of life for us to hold on to those verses at those times. Like I said at the outset, there's a lot of things that we have to remember in this lifetime. So many things. Like I said, I know personally if I get back to the car and I have my keys, I'm going to be happy, but not right? Physically. That's enough, and I can probably get out of here and be okay. And it's important. There's a lot of things you can forget certain things in life and you can be okay. And you can forget certain things, I think, and spiritually as well and probably be okay. But these four things I mentioned, I think, are paramount to who we are and how we walk in our Christian life. As we get into that time of the year when things hit us and overrun us, it's important to remember the God we serve. It's important to relay that this year when we have youth lessons with our young children and our teenagers, when we're talking to them at home. But that's really where it starts, to give them that vision of the greatness, the awesomeness of God, who wants to have a relationship with them, who wants to make it personal. And we think of Jesus Christ and his unwavering obedience and how we should be just wanting to line up. Where we've stumbled, where we fall down, we have that heart, that strong desire, like those boys I could see on my basketball team, that look in their eye that they just want to be the guy. I want to get back in line with you. And that we always remember where we've come from. That will affect how we deal with each other. How we deal with each other, and we never lose sight. May we never lose sight